It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, from swimming pools made of cheese to measuring our age with radiation from our teeth, comic writer Randall Munroe shares some over-the-top scientific solutions to everyday problems. First, walking was a big development for human beings as a species, and learning to walk is a big milestone for the development of individual humans. But as important as walking can be, our next guest says we've designed a world where it can be harder and harder to go for a nice walk, especially if we want some nature along the way. Antonia Malchik is a freelance writer who writes about science, travel, and place. She's the author of A Walking Life. She's worked and walked in Austria, Australia, and Russia. She currently lives and writes from Montana. Antonia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Talk about what got you into this, because walking is something I think is really easy for us humans to take for granted.
It really is. One of the reasons I actually got interested in the subject was because I was living in an area of upstate New York when I first started researching, where it was very hard to walk anywhere. And in fact, once I had kids, I couldn't walk anywhere because the roads weren't safe. They were very narrow. They're sort of these kinds of rural roads that don't have any shoulders and no striping, so no real lanes. And they're supposed to be about 25 miles an hour, but when people start using them for commuting, they go a lot faster and it's quite risky. And I just took a different look at the world around me once I had kids. I thought, my gosh, I can't take them anywhere unless I buckle them into a car seat. And that's really strange when you think about the entirety of human evolution and human history, that we have this whole world now where you can live in a place and not realize that you don't have access to walking anywhere, that you are actually forced to get places by car. And that's kind of started me down the road of researching the subject, and it just ballooned out of there. It's a huge topic.
Yeah, it's amazing from a biomechanical perspective too, all the stuff that goes into taking one or two steps.
It's incredible. Some of the earliest research I did led me to engineering departments that try to build walking robots. And you might have seen videos, mm-hmm. people might have seen videos from Boston Dynamics, for example, where they have robot dogs that are really quite versatile and they can self-correct their steps. And they make these robots that can open doors. But the amount of work that goes into that is just incredible. And what I found out was that every time we take a step as human beings with our 2 feet that balance on the ground on like 2 little points every time we lift up 1 foot, is that we make about 1 billion calculations per step. And no walking robot actually gets close to that.
Wow.
Yet. They're getting closer, but it's just, you know, the world is a varied place. And especially once you're out of a lab, there's just so much going on underfoot and in the air and in your visual field. And your brain accounts for all of it. And we don't even think about that.
You cover a lot of ground in your book, and you've covered a lot of ground walking in preparation for this book. One thing we wanted to focus on some today was walking, not just anywhere, but in nature or with some kind of nature-like substance around us. Talk about the benefits that can have for our, not just physical, but our mental health too.
It's actually it's a field that's growing, I think, and I can't, you know, verify that particular thing with statistics, but I keep running into more and more studies that cover the beneficial effects of walking in nature or walking in green spaces. Say if you live in a city that has really good parks, like Denver, for example, is a city with really beautiful, incredible parks and green spaces that you can walk in. Its effects on your mental health. So depression, anxiety, some more serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia have been shown to decrease even with 20-minute walks in nature, up to an hour is even more. Children with ADHD, if they spend 20 minutes per day in green spaces, just even, you know, running around and doing what kids do, the effects on them can be almost as significant as with medication. There's been a lot of studies on even physical health, the outcomes of physical health in people with lower socioeconomic status. This is specifically out of Britain. For example, even though they have access to all the same medical care because they have a national health plan, it's not as good in general, but that can be balanced out by having access to green spaces. And so it's really incredible. And some of the studies I've run into, like one out of the University of Michigan, is starting to look at how the brain actually responds to nature versus, say, being in a city. And what they're finding is that being in green spaces, especially quieter ones that don't have a lot of traffic noise, bring your attention into a calmer space. So it takes your attention from what they call a bottom-up fashion that's much more relaxed, whereas urban environments tend to demand your attention in ways that are more stressful.
Talking to Anthony Amalchik, author of the book A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Freedom One Step at a Time. You talk about Denver a fair amount in your book as a city that's trying to turn things around when it comes to walking and, to an extent, green space. Do you see this as a trend? More communities saying, hey, we got to make it so we can walk again.
Well, I sometimes wonder if I'm a little biased because I talk to so many people who do work in this field, especially urban planners and walkability activists. But I do feel like it's a trend. And part of the reason is that there's pressure from a lot of different directions. There's the health direction. You know, we all know that we don't move enough in our lives. Sitting is really bad for us. And yet the way that our world is structured doesn't give us a lot of opportunity to change that. So instead of walking to work or walking to school, we're always in the car. And so a lot of people just feel trapped by that. And younger generations in particular don't want that kind of life anymore. They want a lifestyle where they can just be active in their daily lives without having to get a gym membership, show up there for an hour, and then sit at your desk for 7 or 8 hours a day. So there's that pressure. Every city, every rural area is growing. I live in a town of about 7,000 people, and my entire county is growing really fast. And the more people who live in a place, the more you have to accommodate them getting around. And, you know, we've all seen pictures of like Los Angeles traffic, or maybe we sit in Los Angeles traffic or New York City traffic. I've certainly sat in traffic in New York City. Or you just sit there thinking, why would we do this to ourselves? You know, I have lived in Europe off and on over the years, and it is very different to know that you don't have to have a car to get places. So there's a lot of pressure from younger generations to provide more options for mobility, walking and public transportation as a combination. And I think people just, they want a different kind of life in a lot of ways. They want more connected communities, especially over the last few years. That theme comes up more and more frequently. A lot of people are tired of, you know, living in suburbs that are disconnected from a wider community, you know, living in a place where you can't walk to a coffee shop, you can't walk to a post office, you don't really see your neighbors. And people are realizing that something they're craving is not necessarily, you know, the right size house with a two-car garage, but connection with other people in ways that feel healthy and mobile.
And you write Antonia, that it's not just a matter of we've chosen to stop walking and to start driving. You write that we've designed our communities in ways that make it prohibitively difficult, as you were saying earlier, to choose to walk.
Yes. One of the sources that I talk to quite a bit is a man named Peter Norton, who's a, what does he study? The history of technology. And he wrote this amazing book called Fighting Traffic that really delves into the early 1900s and how we lost walking through car-centric design. And it wasn't something that people chose. It was very much pushed on the American population and really on the North American population, because Canada has very similar infrastructure in a lot of ways, by the car industry and the oil industry. And I'm sure that those industries didn't intend to make a world that wasn't walkable. But what they thought they were doing was, well, first of all, they were selling cars, which is, you know, really important. But they were selling this idea of freedom. You know, you get in your car and you can just drive where you need to go. And the idea is never part of that. Pedestrian deaths, traffic crashes, that's never part of that image. And there was a huge fight at the beginning of the 1900s, around the 1920s, to get cars out of cities, actually, or at least to reduce their speeds to about 5 miles per hour. And that's because there were just so many deaths, especially of children, because everybody had the right to the roads at that time. If you look at videos from that time period, there were no traffic lights, there's no stop signs, there's no crosswalks. Everybody's just all over the place, and that's how it was. And partly as a result, a lot of people died once cars really started to come on the road, and a lot of drivers were irresponsible. Well, the answer to that, instead of kind of limiting car use within cities, was to shunt pedestrians and other traffic, quote unquote, say bicycles, to the sidewalks. And so we lost access to the road as a public space. And then over time, you know, the highway bill came through and a lot of suburbs were built to serve highways, and then highways were built to serve suburbs, and it kind of turned into this self-feeding highway building frenzy. And what you find is in a lot of the like mid-century suburbs, you will still have some sidewalks, but they're pretty limited. And then as time goes on, there's just no sidewalks at all. You just have the road to your cul-de-sac to your garage. And you realize that people don't make that choice. It's made for them by the people who are designing the space, and then through things like zoning laws and engineering requirements. I was listening to the previous guest, Lord Brown, and he was talking about engineering needing to serve the needs of human beings. And I think this is a case where engineering did not do that. It served the needs of one industry and this kind of fantasy of what car ownership would be, that it would be freedom, when it turned out to take away freedom.
We're talking about the benefits and joys of walking, walking in nature, walking in communities, and the obstacles to doing it. Antonia Malchik is with us, author of the book A Walking Life, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your community like? Is it walkable? Do you make time to walk just for the heck of it? Do you build it into your commute, your trip to the coffee shop? Is there something to walk to where you live? What would make it easier to get out and go for a walk? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the benefits of joys of walking. Antonia Malchik is with us. Her recently published book is called A Walking Life. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go out walking after midnight, before midnight, any time of day? Do you like to go for a walk in nature? Is it possible to go for a nice walk in your part of the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We asked Antonia around here at Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Television. Susan writes, she just moved here from Florida. She loves the Madison Parks and Madison Fun Walks every weekend. They even went this past February to a walk in sleet, rain, and snow. Six of us started. She says only four made it through to the end. You are a fan, I think, Antonia, of walking rain or shine, right?
I am a very big fan. And something that happened when I first started working on this was I would, you know, my friends would want to meet for coffee and I'd say, hey, let's go for a walk. And what I would find is that if it were windy, if it were a little too hot, a little too cold, raining, any of those conditions, my friends would be like, I only really want to go for a walk if the weather's nice out. I thought, man, that's, you know, 100 years and we've just discarded a whole lot of evolution. I love hearing that from your caller, because I just went on a huge hike in Glacier National Park. Well, not huge compared to some people, but it was a big long day hike. It was about 19 miles. And it was the east side of Glacier National Park. And we had weather, a lot of rain where I lived that morning. And over when you get to East Glacier, the weather changes quite a bit. And it had snowed quite a bit up high. And we were hiking up there and we got hailed on and we were tramping through snow and we saw wolverine tracks, and it was actually, objectively speaking, it was kind of miserable, but it felt so invigorating to just be in the world. And that's something that I keep coming back to over and over in my own experience and in different kinds of research, like neuroscience. Just how our brains develop has a lot to do with how we interact with the world. And so I find it really fascinating to just be in the world, no matter what's going on. The one caveat we have where I live is we do get wildfire smoke. And this has been not a bad year for that, but it's getting worse over the years. And so that does kind of keep us indoors. But otherwise, I just find you know, we can trudge through in any weather. My kids aren't super happy about that, but they've gotten used to it. We buy a lot of rain gear and they put up with it. And recently, I don't know, I was sick recently and I was like, oh, let's just drive down to the farmer's market. And they just looked at me and they were like, we've got raincoats. We'll be fine. Just deal with it, Mom. So maybe a victim of my own advice.
Well, it worked. Sure. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Steele is with us in Appleton. Steele, hi.
Hey, everybody. My comment, and I was just looking online. People are looking at screens, and then they say you need to take a break, and they say 20 feet. But sometimes, let's say the guy's living in New York City, and then that special day when the sun comes up down the road, but you need to walk a little, and you need to see the horizon. You need to see more than 20 feet. You need to see a few miles to and even if it's a short walk and you can't drive somewhere to, walk around the snow.
Steele, thanks a lot for that call. So a lot there, actually, Anthony, getting away from the screen for a walk, but also changing your view from that screen 2 feet away to 20 feet or even the horizon.
Yeah, which hits on a couple of different things. You know, one of them is that there are increasing cases of myopia in our culture because we do spend so much time on our screens, and children especially, you know, since they're still developing, they suffer from that a lot. And from being indoors too much, there's a lot of illnesses that are starting to resurface that are caused because of vitamin D deficiency, basically, and because kids do spend so much time indoors and on screens, they've really become subject to that. But there's also the psychological aspect, which I think your caller hit on a little bit, which is there's a sense of ease when you're able to look out over a distance. My husband's from England and he grew up in Nottingham, which is a big industrial city, and his parents never owned a car and they would love it when we'd come to visit because I was the only driver in the family. And so we'd rent a car and go up to Scotland and they just loved being able to look out over the horizon. As he said, it just makes a huge difference, I think, in anxiety levels, in depression. There's a lot more research about these things. Just being able to readjust your sense of perspective and your sense of place in the world, I think it affects us on a lot of different levels of being human in ways that we're not even conscious of.
Thanks for that call, Steele. We're talking to Anthony Amelchik, author of the book A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom, One Step at a Time. Back to your calls. Paul is with us in Chicago. Paul, hello.
Hello. Sorry, I'm in a car.
That's okay. What do you want to tell us about, Paul?
Well, I grew up in a very small town. I was a distance runner for a long time, so, you know, you'd run out on roads and stuff. I remember when the mayor of the town asked me what kind of improvement they should do, and I said, don't pave the roads, keep them gravel. He didn't want to hear that. But the point I wanted to make was that a lot of people talk about this as though it's sort of communing with nature, that you have to be in a pristine wilderness to enjoy it. And I think some of the people that I've known that have been the biggest walkers are people who live in places like Manhattan or Chicago, where, you know, you're taking the subway, but you're always walking four or five blocks, going anywhere several times a day. And some people will just, you know, oh, it's a mile, but I'm just going to walk it, you know. So I want to comment on that.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And I'm guessing, Anthony, no argument from you about the benefits of urban walking.
Absolutely not. I did focus a lot on urban settings in my book, and partly because most people live in cities. And I am fortunate enough to live next to millions of acres of wilderness and Glacier National Park. But almost nobody in the world has that kind of access. And I think it's really important that you're able to feel fully alive and fully human wherever it is that you live. There's actually, I think you said the caller was from Chicago. There's an organization called the Center for Humans and Nature that's based in Chicago. And one of the things they are constantly doing is trying to get people to focus on the small little pockets of nature that are within cities as well. And I think that's just part of walking in general, like living at a walking pace, that you pay attention to what's around you, whatever it happens to be. I lived in Boston for a couple of years, and one of the abiding memories I have is all the window boxes that people put out in the spring. it's a really big thing there. And you just walk around and you look at all these tiny little petunias and marigolds and things that people are growing on their, you know, brick buildings. And it's beautiful. And you can connect with nature in a city. You can connect with people in a city. And you definitely can connect with yourself in a city. I actually really love city walking.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Antonia, before we run out of time, you don't just write about walking exactly in your book. You also look at people who might be in wheelchairs, have paraplegia, people who do walk with some kind of prosthesis. Talk about how that fit into your picture of walking.
Well, it actually came about because one of the things is I've read just tons and tons of books about walking and around walking, and only one of them had even briefly mentioned disability. And I thought that was really strange because one of the things I get to into the book is evolution and evolutionary biology and this idea that bipedality, you know, this walking on two feet is what makes us human because it's unique to the human species. And I thought, well, if you're going to say that walking makes us human, then you really need to address that in the context of disability. What if you are not bipedal? And part of the reason that's important to me is because there's two people in my family who get around with wheelchairs. And I say at the beginning of the book that really walking, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, it is bipedality. But from a perspective of being human, for me, it's just being as fully present in the world as is possible for every human being. And I think as far as infrastructure goes, it is really essential that we provide that for everybody. And universal design is, that's part of it. You have to, if your only way of getting around outside is with a wheelchair, then there's no reason that we can't build infrastructure that accommodates that. And that kind of design actually does benefit everybody, say small children, you know, elderly people who might be a little less stable. And I think it's a really important aspect of walking and also about the future of walking. When you're looking at prosthetics and robotics, those things are going through huge advances. And it's really, I think, going to change the way we think about being human. And it's a fascinating area of research and future work as far as technology goes.
Antonia, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's Antonia Malchuk. We've been talking about her book, A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom, One Step at a Time. Coming up after the news, have you ever wondered about how to land an airplane in an emergency? How about land a falling house if you're in a Wizard of Oz type movie? We'll talk to a scientist and author who has all the answers you didn't know you needed. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Hurricane Dorian's winds are decreasing, but the storm may be turning even more destructive. We'll get an update on where it is and where it may be headed next. First, jumping, throwing a pool party, charging your phone. These are pretty basic activities humans already have a pretty good handle on. But doing things the easy way doesn't help us learn much. But what if we hold that pool party in a swimming pool made of Gruyere cheese, using bottled water with the bottles opened by a nuclear weapon? Okay, no, we wouldn't actually do that, I hope, but by answering the question of how it could be done, we stand to learn a lot. Randall Monroe is the creator of the web comic XKCD. His new book is How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Randall, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you tackle throughout the book all these kind of basic day-to-day problems, how to jump high, how to build a swimming pool, how to cross a river, but in the most difficult ways possible. What is your goal in trying to think about these weird solutions to everyday problems?
You know, to be honest, whenever I always tend to make things difficult, and deep down I always suspect maybe this will actually make it easier. Like, maybe this will work. I don't go out looking for the worst way to do something. I just try to find a different way of doing something. And, you know, most of the time, ideas that seem bad or ridiculous are bad or ridiculous. But you never really know until you work through them and try to figure out what would happen.
Well, in your intro, you give this example of how to, say, land a big rover on Mars. And one of the ideas that seems outlandish and ridiculous, they actually went with. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. When they were trying to land the rover, Curiosity was much heavier than all the previous rovers they'd sent. And the usual approach of having airbags and parachutes to slow it down wouldn't work in Mars's thin atmosphere. And they came up with all these other ideas, and they thought about putting rockets on the rover to make it land, but it would kick up too much dust, and the system has to land automatically, so it would interfere. And someone had the idea of dangling the robot from what they called a sky crane, which was a hovering rocket-powered platform that would then lower the robot slowly on a rope, like a tether, and set it down gently on the ground while staying high enough up that the rockets didn't kick up dust, and then fly off sideways to crash so it didn't fall straight down onto the rover. And this sounded like the most ridiculous idea, but every other idea that they had was worse. And they tried it, and it actually worked, because they went over it, they couldn't find any problems, and they were like, okay, I think we can do this. So sometimes, now and then, those ridiculous ideas turn out okay. I mean, like, smearing mold on a cut doesn't seem like a very good idea, but it is how we discovered antibiotics.
You tackle a bunch of different problems, and if it's funny all the way through, but if we're not careful, we might learn a thing or two. I want to get into that swimming pool made of Gruyere. You have a chapter on how to hold a pool party without a pool, and you kind of have this lesson in material sciences with different things we could build a pool out of, from tinfoil to wood. Can you talk about what you were tackling there?
Yeah, well, I don't have a pool, and I was thinking, if I had to make one on short notice, how would I do it? And so I got to talk about, in-ground and above-ground pools and how they're constructed. And one thing I really like about science and physics is that you can come up with a formula that shows you the tension in the side of a fiberglass pool, and it'll tell you, is this tension bigger or smaller than the breaking strength of the fiberglass? But physics doesn't care if the questions you're asking it are ridiculous or not. So you can just take that same equation and plug in the tensile strength and density of Gruyere cheese, and it'll spit out, like, here's how thick your pool needs to be to contain the water. And I love that you can just, like, ask a silly question like that, but then you can actually get the answer. Even if it's not useful for really anything in particular in that case, I don't think that's going to be the next landing a rover on Mars.
We're in Wisconsin. I don't know. We've got a lot of cheese to build pools out of. You also
send your own rover.
Exactly. You also look at how to fill that pool, and one solution you look at is, of course, to order thousands and thousands of bottles of bottled water, but then to speed up opening it. What if we used a nuclear weapon? And this is a recurring theme in the book. It sounds ridiculous, but many things that sound ridiculous, the U.S. government has studied. What would happen to, say, a container, a plastic container, a metal container, in case of a nuclear explosion?
Well, this is a thing that the government studied during the Cold War, and I think it's funny that sometimes I'll come up with what I think is a ridiculous idea and then find that some serious researchers have come up with an even more ridiculous one, especially in that early Cold War period when no one really knew where this was all headed, and they were trying out some pretty wild things. But they did test out putting different they said the effect of nuclear weapons on commercially packaged beverages was the title of this long report, where they set out a bunch of beer and soda bottles and under a nuclear test site and checked how much damage they sustained and whether the drinks inside were still good. And the reason for this they gave was that they wanted to know if these fluids would still be a source of hydration in a cleanup, after a nuclear attack for the emergency response. I sort of wonder, though, they got the beverages, if you read the report, from local retailers. I sort of wonder if the entire project wasn't concocted because someone got caught buying drinks on their government account.
Yeah, no, we're buying all these Cokes for nuclear testing. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. And the bouncy castle is for survivability of impact. Quick, let's find some engineering words for this.
We're talking to Randall Monroe. His new book is How to Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Another one that you tackled that I love is, okay, we've got pianos. I'm looking at one right now in our studio. They've got 88 keys. You tackled the question of, okay, what if we wanted a piano that can produce basically any physically producible sound that something might be able to hear or detect? How do you figure out how many keys that piano needs?
Well, there's a pretty straightforward relationship between the frequency of a key and, its ordering. They go up by a set interval. And so this was a question actually someone wrote in and suggested, what if you extend it in either direction? And it turns out it's really fun because you can just, the piano can just keep going. after you go, you can go a few dozen keys in either direction and you'll encompass all the sounds that humans can hear, but you can go even farther than that. And so I looked at, if you could build a piano like this, you'd have to use something other than strings, because strings don't work very well for producing extremely high frequencies. And for extremely low frequencies, the piano would need to be larger than the building it was in. But there are ways to do it. And so if you built this, you could play sounds that are too low to hear or too high for even bats and dogs to hear. And what's fun is that those sounds would be mixing with all the real high and low frequency sounds that are sloshing around in the, you know, in the atmosphere right now. High frequency sounds don't travel very far, but there are low frequency sounds going past us all the time that we can't detect unless we have equipment that can pick up these low, slow pressure waves. But they're caused by things like meteors and machinery and even like volcanic eruptions. And it's neat to realize that there's this sort of music out there that we can't hear.
One drawback, though, would be if we're playing the really low notes, the nuclear weapon detectors around the world might be set off.
Yes, I included a piece of music. If someone does build one of these pianos, it's one of the few things in the book that I think you actually could do fairly straightforwardly. It wouldn't be too difficult or too expensive if you use this rotary woofer. It's a piece of equipment for doing extreme bass notes. But I wrote a piece of music that's it's, you know, many octaves below a normal piano. And you could play it. It wouldn't be audible to people, but it would show up on anyone doing infrasound monitoring. And one of the main groups doing infrasound monitoring is people who are looking for the characteristic air pulse from a secret nuclear test. So you would definitely, if you play this piece of music, I arranged it so that it will draw out a stick figure on their monitoring equipment.
Now, the chapter I was laughing out loud the most at, enough to get attention from colleagues down the hall here at WPR, was how to make an emergency landing. You brought in a special guest. You did a Q&A interview with Chris Hadfield, the famous astronaut and test pilot. And in addition to all his credentials, it seems, Randall, that he's also one of the most patient people on Earth. He really stuck with you through some wild questions.
You know, I think that's my favorite chapter, too. He was just so much fun to talk to. And the funny thing is, he's very, you know, he's an astronaut, so he's very, he's got that air traffic control voice. Everything is always calm, measured, you know, no excitement or, you know, startled, or he never seems taken aback or surprised or anything. It took me a little bit to realize how much he was really enjoying the exercise. I kept on, you know, giving him a chance to finish, and he was, you know, oh, I know you have somewhere to be, and he's like, no, let's
keep
get through the rest of these questions. But it was, what was fun was I was expecting that the interview would be, you know, I'd ask him about some things, he'd give me some interesting tips, and I'd write an article, and I arranged my questions from, like, the least ridiculous up to the most ridiculous, you know, starting with some simple questions about, like, landing in, like, farmers' fields and unusual places, and then working my way up to you know, landing if you're trapped on the outside of a plane, working the flaps with your hands, or how to land on ski jumps and stuff like that. And to my surprise, and I figured I'd just keep asking him the weirder and weirder questions until he got impatient, you know, and everyone was just like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever been asked, and hung up on me. But he just answered all of them. I couldn't stump him. You know, and sometimes the answer was like, oh, there's no way to do that. You would, there's no way to make that landing safely. You'll almost certainly, it won't be survivable or whatever. But a lot of the time he was just like, oh yeah, that's easy. You can do that. Here's how.
Can I spoil the last question you asked him? Because it's how to land a rock. So what if I'm picked up, you write, by a rock, the giant mythical bird? How should I try to force it to put me down without dropping me? And his first line of his answer is, your best bet is to treat it like a big angry hang glider.
Yeah,
I think that's the part where I got a lot of attention from my laughing.
Yeah, I had kept that question like at the end of my notes when I was going
to
call him, because I'm like, well,
I mean,
if I run through everything else and I can't, you know, I guess I can bring out this one. But and I even then I was like, I know this one's outside your area of expertise. But no, he answered it. And what's really wild is reading it. You might think it's, you know, been really, you know, edited down. Here are his concise points. But there would just be no pause. I'd ask the question and he would just launch into the answer, thinking out loud, you know, working through what he'd do in response to being picked up by a giant bird. And I realized that maybe my initial plan of trying to stump a test pilot astronaut by throwing weird situations at them, like, that may have had some flaws. But on the other hand, I am just absolutely delighted by how that turned out. He was a great sport, and that's, I think, my favorite chapter in the book.
As we wrap up, Randall, it seems like you're almost combining a childlike sense of wonder and always asking why or what if with the actual science that would answer the what if question. How can the rest of us kind of cultivate that attitude of thinking?
I don't know. You know, I don't really know about, kids and education and stuff, but I've really never had the sense that kids are more creative or have more of a sense of wonder than adults. I think the difference to me seems that kids are less embarrassed about not knowing things because they don't know, lots of things all the time. My secret opinion is that all Q&As after all technical presentations would be better if they were limited to kids under 12, because no kid, kids, they might not ask questions that they might have an easy answer. They might misunderstand things, but a kid will never say I have more of a comment than a question. And they just have good, straightforward questions that they want to know the answer to, and I think it's the best lesson that I have from all this is just when you don't know the answer to something, even if it sounds like a ridiculous question, just swallow the pride and ask it. My New Year's resolution was to, when people used words I didn't know, I would ask them what they meant. And it was really weirdly hard. I shouldn't have any insecurities about that, but I really do. So I think letting go of insecurity about not knowing things and asking questions is a way, a great way to go. Cause everyone's interested in this kind of weird stuff, I think.
Randall, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
That's Randall Monroe. He writes the webcomic XKCD. We talked to him about his new book, How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. Coming up, we'll get the latest on Hurricane Dorian and take a look at what else is brewing in the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear a lot about a teacher shortage in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Our guest says there's really a teacher exodus with a crisis of teachers leaving the profession. Now, after stalling out over the Bahamas the last couple of days, Hurricane Dorian is starting to make its way slowly to the northwest. The National Hurricane Center says the winds continue to weaken, but the storm appears to be growing in size. Meteorologists say that means it could actually be more destructive than it was when it was smaller and windier. Here in the state, Governor Evers has authorized the Wisconsin National Guard to assist civil authorities in Florida, and the Wisconsin Humane Society has brought in 33 cats that were evacuated from Florida over the weekend. So where is Dorian likely to go? What other tropical activities should we be keeping an eye on? Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. He's covered more than 100 Atlantic hurricanes, including Katrina's landfall in 2005. John, welcome back to the show.
Rob, it's great to be with you.
Well, can you give us the latest information on Dorian, where it is, how big it is, and how fast it's moving?
Well, currently, the center of Hurricane Dorian is located about 100 miles east of Vero Beach, Florida. And, fortunately today, it's actually moving instead of stalling out. It's moving to the northwest at about 5 miles per hour, which doesn't sound very fast forward motion, but it had been stalled out for over 36 hours over the northwest Bahamas. So at least it's moving, but it's still packing winds of 110 miles per hour. That's a Category 2 hurricane. And as you mentioned earlier, it's growing larger, so that means its wind field is growing.
We've talked about this before, John. It sounds like it's good news when it goes from Category 4 to 3 and 3 to 2. It's not necessarily as reassuring as it sounds, though, right?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. That's the problem. The Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale, which refers to the Category 1, 2, and 3 that we're all familiar hearing, all that really factors in is how strong the maximum winds are in a hurricane. It doesn't tell you anything about how big the wind field is, how vast of an area is seeing hurricane force winds and tropical storm force winds. And so what's kind of, it sounds paradoxical, but as it was hammering the northwest Bahamas, it was a Category 5, obviously an attention getter, but it was small. Now it's actually weakening in its maximum sustained winds, but its wind field is growing larger, so it's likely to affect a pretty large swath of the southeast coast over the next few days.
Now, we're still waiting to see how badly hit the Bahamas were, how big the damage is, hoping, I guess, for the least bad we can hope for there. Is it unusual for a hurricane to park itself to stall for such a long period of time?
Well, unfortunately, it's not unusual in the sense that sometimes the steering currents of hurricanes collapse. So one way to visualize what happened is hurricanes are usually steered by large areas of high pressure to their north. And what happened in this particular case is that the steering winds just disappeared for a while. It's as if it lost its steering wheel and there was just nothing to push it along. It's as if you're driving down the road and all of a sudden you take your foot off the gas and you let your car just coast to a stop. So it's not unusual that it happened, although it did spend over 36 hours with the eyewall pounding Grand Bahama Island, and that is truly incredible at that particular intensity.
Now, watching its course in the future, it seems like charts show it kind of veering and shearing along the U.S. eastern seaboard, Florida and the Carolinas in particular. What are you watching for next?
Yeah, this isn't a really good scenario, to be honest. You know, there can be some hurricanes which head right toward a section of the coast, quickly make landfall, they hit a section of the coast hard, and then they move away. The problem with Dorian, and similar to what we saw with Hurricane Matthew 3 years ago, if you remember that hurricane, is it's going to kind of parallel the coast from just east of the Florida coast and then very closely hug the coast of Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina through Friday. So there's a pretty large section of the coast that could see hurricane force winds from the Carolina coast through the east coast of Florida. And also that's going to produce dangerous storm surge and battering waves riding atop the surge with a lot of beach erosion. So this is just going to be a mess up and down the coast.
Talking to Jonathan Erdman with weather.com, looking at Hurricane Dorian as it approaches the U.S. east coast. And that's not the only one we're keeping an eye on, John. Is it a tropical storm now in the Gulf of Mexico we're watching?
It is. You know, we're in the heart of hurricane season now, so we typically don't just have one thing out there. We usually have several. And we just had Tropical Storm Fernand that formed in the western Gulf of Mexico today. Now, that's going to move inland pretty quickly, so it's not going to have a chance to become a beast like Dorian did. But it could produce some heavy rain for northeast Mexico and maybe the Texas lower Rio Grande Valley. You know, we have a couple other disturbances we're watching. In fact, I just refreshed my browser here. We just have a new tropical depression way out in the eastern Atlantic. That's Tropical Depression 8, which will probably become Tropical Storm Gabrielle at some point. That looks like it's going to stay in the central Atlantic and not threaten any land. But we have a lot of hurricane season left. We have probably two-thirds of the hurricane season left to go, so we'll have to keep a watch on things.
And, yeah, people have been talking about a quiet hurricane season up till now. Is that right?
Well, it was, and I'm guilty of that. You know, I wrote an article about 2 weeks ago saying how we had a lack of storms there for about a four-week period, but that's not unusual. July and June can be quite quiet for a while. And then all of a sudden, almost like a switch, I've seen several hurricane seasons do this where you get to late August and all of a sudden it's one after another as you get to the heart of the season. And I'm afraid we're probably in that mode, at least for a while, until we get maybe past, say, early to mid-October.
Well, that's all Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico. I saw you had tweeted, I think, about a Juliet, a Category 3 hurricane in the Pacific.
Yes, that's right. So Juliet, you know, it was out there, and it wasn't generally a land threat for the most part. And to be honest, I hadn't been giving it too close a watch, given everything else going on. But I found it just fascinating that this poor tiny island that's about 7 square miles, that's a Mexican island of Clarion Island, and you could probably Google it and figure out where that is, was hit by the eyewall of this Category 3 hurricane. Apparently there's only 9 people that live on the island. It's a kind of a Mexican naval outpost, but they were just incredibly unlucky by this eastern Pacific hurricane.
And John, as we wrap up, in the coming 24, 48 hours, what kind of things are you watching for to see where Dorian tracks?
Well, it's a very close call because every few miles difference between the track of the center could mean the difference between the eyewall of Dorian striking more of the southeast coast and maybe the eyewall just staying offshore. Regardless, though, of the track of this, there's going to be destructive storm surge flooding from Florida all the way up to the Carolinas, and there's going to be some strong wind gust and beach erosion, too. So things are going to go downhill in a hurry from Georgia to the Carolinas over the next day or so.
John, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Jonathan Erdman, a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. We talked with him about the latest on Hurricane Dorian. It's expected to move up the East Coast this week after settling destructively over parts of the Bahamas over the last couple of days. Keep following the story over at npr.org. On a lighter note, here's a roundup of cats in the news. In Florida, a reported cat burglar turned out to be a cat. Police in Naples, Florida responded to a 911 call at night. The caller had heard a tapping on their door and the sound of meowing. They thought it was a fake meow used by burglars to lure them to open the door. Responding deputies apprehended a cat named Bones. Police brought the cat to a local shelter for safekeeping while the owner was tracked down. Cat story two, the RCMP near Vancouver responded to a citizen report of a possible cougar on the loose in the metropolitan area. The caller estimated the cat to be about 150 pounds. Responding Mounties determined that the sighting was a house cat, a bit on the large side, but well short of 150 pounds. Finally, some cat news you can use. You may have heard the stereotype about the wacky cat people out there. The cat lady is often the term used. The idea being that people who own a lot of cats and live alone are lonely and or weird in some way. A study of cat owners published in the journal Royal Society Open Science finds no. On a variety of measures of mental health and well-being, owners of multiple cats look just like everybody else. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.